This is the Everybody's Talking at Once podcast for March 19th, 2024. Welcome to the Everybody's Talking at Once podcast, where we talk about everything by talking about games. And today, let's talk about Helldivers 2, the latest from Arrowhead Game Studios. I've been playing their games since grad school, starting with Magicka, a co-op twin-stick spell cast-em-up about mixing elemental magics on the fly to create powerful, unwieldy spells. Arrowhead's central design insight is that what can make a game hard is, sure, putting the player up against overwhelming quantities of adversaries, but also making the player too powerful. Arrowhead loves to give you so much power so early and so often that you will definitely misuse it to obliterate your own character and/or those of your co-op compatriots. In Helldivers 2, we're talking mortar turrets, arc lightning guns, orbital laser strikes. You start with a frankly silly capacity to make things explode, which then only gets sillier from there. This is Arrowhead's first game presented in full over-the-shoulder 3D rather than from a top-down perspective. It's graphically lush, and it can be as lush as it is, not least because, as we'll talk about and for smart thematic reasons, the game doesn't actually simulate that many truly discrete locations or characters. And yet, it feels persistently fresh, expansive, full of little emergent narratives of frantic, against-all-odds combat. The game's missions have you completing one or more objectives on a hostile alien world, activate this, collect that, shoot all of these, before calling down a ship to collect you and your fellow Helldivers. 1 to 3 of these missions makes up an operation, and completing an operation makes the planet on which it took place incrementally more liberated. Thus, do the players collectively influence the overall galactic war, little personal stories tied into a larger, shared, slowly unfurling narrative. And behind all of this, there is Joel. Joel, an apparently actual guy who works at Arrowhead, is the official dungeon master of the Galactic War, pulling the strings of the conflict at the center of the game's plot, such as it is. He also, apparently, has some ability to step in and change individual missions in progress, an idea that was admirably infeasible even before the game became as popular as it currently is. You might recall that the Left 4 Dead games had something sort of similar. An AI, that is, an AI in the meaningful but broad game design sense, not in the borderline meaningless tech hype sense, an AI for making a given run easier or harder on the fly. This system, or this bundle of systems, was called the Director, personified as a malevolent agent, more invested in telling a good story than in your success. The next logical step, beyond the Director, is Joel. The very existence of Joel impels players to approach in-game events, big and small, with a certain paranoia. When a planet is all but conquered and the enemy gains back ground, thereby forestalling or even entirely preventing a victory, players can't help but imagine Joel twirling his mustache, if he has one, even as the other developers insist that those sorts of setbacks are just the game ticking along as it was designed to do. The in-game chat is full of players beseeching Joel to send down a few fewer enemy tanks. In the same way that a panopticon isn't really about always being watched so much as the ever-present possibility that you're being watched, it's not as though Joel is the direct cause of every bad thing that happens to you in Helldivers 2, it's just that he could be. And this feeling of possibly being surveilled and toyed with ends up being thematically important, because while Magicka was mostly a satire of fantasy storytelling and video game power fantasies, shot through with a sort of a puckish, generalized skepticism about authority, received wisdom, and the status quo, the Helldivers games have more ambitious satirical aims.
Super Earth, bastion of peace, prosperity, and managed democracy. For 100 years, our colonists have toiled happily to enshrine the unquestionable rule of freedom. But now, our enemies rise from the shadows once more. The tyrannical Terminids spread unfettered across the galaxy. The socialist automatons terrorize innocent families. Babes are torn from their mothers. Voters from their ballots.
This game is, for my money, a rather sharp satire of militarism in general, of the United States in particular, and of our Manichean war on terror rhetoric and our moribund democratic institutions in even more particular. Super Earth is a neoliberal hellscape of ossified, bellicose government institutions and barely alloyed profiteering. Words like democracy and liberty are omnipresent, but mostly empty signifiers, shibboleths. Voting gets fetishized, not as like a theory of change, not as a step in the process of having a just or responsive government, but as an end unto itself, pointlessly sacred. Super Earth is all the way totalitarian, but it's held on to the familiar rhetoric of a liberal democracy in decline. All of this is pretty easy to ignore in the moment-to-moment gameplay, even as it pervades the game's tone, with soldiers crying out, "Sweet liberty!" when being shot, and "You will never destroy our way of life!" when shooting. You're fighting for democracy, you're told, but you see a whole lot of fighting and not a whole lot of democracy. And well, you're fighting for managed democracy, which, as the first game explains, uses a sort of BuzzFeed quiz to determine voters' true desires and intentions and interests. A step removed from voting for representatives, which is of course already itself a step removed from voting for, like, policies. Because the second game takes place a century after the first, it's not entirely clear that that's still what managed democracy means, or whether it means anything in particular. The government's machinations are entirely opaque, except as they pertain to war. Whatever it pretends, Super Earth is a society based on strict hierarchies and endless warfare. In a word, fascism. Helldivers 2 is playing with fire, honestly, by building itself on the iconography and rhetoric of fascism and inviting us to indulge in it in this, an historical moment when actual fascism is very much on the rise. So what is the game up to? And does it pull it off? To answer those questions, I'm going to compare Helldivers 2 to other games about war, sure, but I'm also going to take a look at war more broadly and at the tricky business of making art about fascism without making fascist art, or, perhaps even worse, inadvertently making art that is useful to fascists. Being asked to obey completely, to kill and die without ever having access to the full context of the war effort, the very idea of a chain of command, the very social category of soldier, it's all sort of horrific and absurd, isn't it? I'm not denying that there are things worth fighting for, or even things worth dying for, but being asked to give up your one precious life, and to be at peace with that never really being an informed decision, at peace with the idea that what your blood is being spent on is ultimately none of your business? Take a single step back, and what words are there other than horrific and absurd? I think it is for precisely this reason that the figure of the soldier in militaristic societies demands to be taken seriously. We're casually expected to think of soldiers who die fighting for their country as having done something noble. We're definitely not supposed to blame their deaths on the comfortable, wealthy, powerful politicians who sent them to die, and we're definitely not supposed to linger on the often quite dubious reasons for which they've sent them to die. We're supposed to avoid, at all costs, the obvious truth that individual acts of bravery can be, and often are, squandered on vain, venal, opportunistic, even outright evil operational goals. The very idea of ordinary soldiers being not just brave and dutiful, but heroic, is an idea of fairly recent vintage, and it has everything to do with rallying people to die in massive world wars, conflicts with existential stakes and clear moral dimensions, but which are also undeniably ways for great powers to self-servingly clamor for more territory, more influence, more power. I've quoted this section of Umberto Eco's famous essay on fascism before. It was in the context of revisiting the game Moon. I promise it makes sense if you go read my piece. But I want to bring the text up again here, because it's achingly relevant to the semiotics of video game protagonists, even when fascism isn't an explicit part of the text. Eco says that,
"In every mythology, the hero is an exceptional being, But in Ur-fascist ideology, heroism is the norm. This cult of heroism is strictly linked with the cult of death.
It can, of course, be seen as transgressive in some circles to say that the United States Armed Forces or the Israeli Defense Force, say, could be operating within a cult of death. But Super Earth is inarguably doing so. Super Earth is all but explicitly Ur-fascist in a way that most modern fascisms avoid being, which is the whole reason that Echo wanted to map out their common traits, such as making heroism available to anyone willing to fight and die for the state. As such, Super Earth is a good vehicle for taking a closer look at how the cult of death operates. So then, Echo continues.
In non-fascist societies, the lay public is told that death is unpleasant, but must be faced with dignity. Believers are told that it is the painful way to reach a supernatural happiness. By contrast, the Ur-fascist hero craves heroic death, advertised as the best reward for a heroic life. The Ur-fascist hero is impatient to die. In his impatience, he more frequently sends other people to death.
We'll return to the question of whether we can effectively puncture the seriousness of warfare by acknowledging the absurdity of the cult of death. Maybe, but we do not necessarily puncture the idea that soldiers are intrinsically heroic by leaning into the horror of their situation. It's perfectly possible to draw an audience into the aesthetics and affect of fascism while also putting the ordinary soldier's lack of context, putting the horror of low information, at the center of your story. Perhaps you've heard of Attack on Titan. In case you haven't, it's a manga and anime series about mostly teenage soldiers fighting giant inhuman humanoids called Titans, which are ever besieging the walled island nation of Paradis. As far as we know, when the story begins, the humans behind these walls on this island are the only humans left in the world. Everyone else having presumably been killed and devoured, we should note, by Titans. There is an instantly fascist logic to this story. Humanity is under siege by an enemy that is humanish but fundamentally inhuman. Utterly destroying this enemy is both morally righteous and existentially necessary. If we fail to wipe them out, we will cease to exist. We will be consumed by something stronger than us, but also lesser. Only heroic sacrifices by brave soldiers forever can save us from this. If you've read Echo's Field Guide to Fascism, then basically all of that will be ringing some especially alarming alarm bells. And then the Titans themselves, misshapen humans, oddly proportioned, always grinning, oddly childlike, reflexively violent. The sorts of dysgenic abominations, in other words, that authoritarian societies love to conjure as a contrast to their own strength and purity. And I do want to be clear that even as sinister as I find all of this, it works. In the early goings, this story is rousing, especially in the anime, where combat against the Titans plays out in remarkably trackable action set pieces of supernaturally fast futurist hyperviolence. We care about these battle teens. We fear for their safety. We feel the threat of the Titans, the necessity of violence against them, the status of the military as the only institution capable of addressing the problem. We also feel the horror of low information. As the story begins, and for some time thereafter, we know virtually nothing about the world beyond the walls, and the further from the walls we're talking about, the less we know. And the Titans are, again, initially, an utterly incomprehensible threat. How did they come to exist? Why do they eat people? Having to wage war against a monstrous foe, having to forever live a moment away from being eaten alive without knowing any of that? Well, it's an extrapolation of what soldiers are always expected to do. To kill and to die without context. As Ruben Ferdinand and Elliot Trinidad have pointed out, even as Attack on Titan does start doling out information about the world and about what Titans are, it does so by allusion, gesturing at literally unspeakable truths. Here, they're discussing the revelation that Titans don't have to eat for nutrition, that they photosynthesize like plants. But wait, would that mean...
When they arrive at this hypothesis, they freeze up. None of them say it out loud. They look disturbed by the thought, but the suggestion permeates the room that maybe Titans eat for entertainment, suddenly the Titans make a bit more horrible sense. Their awkward, almost playful body language, their puerile attitudes and vacant smiles. The characters may know, but they never say it. Here, the learning process gets outsourced to the audience in an intrusive way. Attack on Titan instrumentalizes the power of suggestion, leaving just enough room audience side for an affective terror. Affect is ultimately rooted in what we can't compartmentalize. We can know we're scared, but not knowing why we're scared is even scarier. Establishing and exposing these monsters as truly mindless, violent, and abhorrent gives the narrative an impenetrable excuse. The extermination of Titans is indubitably a good thing.
When we do eventually get clear answers about what the world beyond parody is like, and about where the Titans come from, and why they are the way they are, why they eat, well, as is often the case when an author is obliged to open a long-sealed mystery box, the answers range from pretty dumb to extremely dumb. And here, the answers are also full of Shinzo Abe-style Japanese nationalism and old-school blood-libel anti-Semitism. The text becomes fascist through and through, not just in its logic or its contours, but we don't need to dwell on any of that stuff in the middle. We can skip to the end. What's important for our purposes is that the series ends with its protagonist murdering 4/5 of the entire human population for reasons that he himself has a hard time articulating. And this isn't leading to a reveal. No explanation is forthcoming. At no point do his motivations become any more clear to us, or as far as we can tell, to him. Whatever else this ending is, certainly it's the most extreme of all possible doublings down on the horror of low information. It renders everything unknowable, including our own motivations. It's the idea that, as Sigmund Freud put it,
rather than living our lives, we are lived by unknown and uncontrollable forces.
Here Freud was actually paraphrasing the then-famous ethno-nationalism and eugenics liker Georg Grodek, and the two of them didn't actually entirely agree on the anatomy of the subconscious, and like, is there even an anatomy of the subconscious? It's a mess. But it's the perfect kind of mess for this conversation, right? A total confusion, a mutual negation, with more than a trace of a sinister ideology baked into it. What the fuck am I saying? What the fuck I'm saying is that the notion that humans don't have free will, however earnestly or however curiously we might pose the question, it is, in the end, mostly just a gift to authoritarians. If we're lived by unknown and uncontrollable forces, then we're radically unfree. In so hopeless a situation, why not give up our political freedom? We're not really free to choose, so why pretend otherwise? This isn't bravely facing up to harsh truths. This is just despair with extra steps. The sickness unto the cult of death. Now, in the text of Attack on Titan, the protagonist is being lived by an unknown and uncontrollable force, who is herself driven by irrational, violent, self-negating, mostly unclear motivations. Again, the details aren't what we're here to talk about, but also, they don't matter in a much deeper way, because the series ends on a total rejection of meaning and hope. It treats the utterly irredeemable protagonist with an unearned sense of sentimentality, while treating the story itself and its audience with pure contempt. It's an ending where, as FD Signifier has said,
nothing of value ever lasts or is really ever worth the effort. And even if you have the literal power of gods and titans, that you'll still fuck it up somehow. And maybe flattening everything and starting over is the only way. And the pain caused from that doesn't matter. And if that doesn't make sense to you or doesn't satisfy you as a fan, good. Fuck you. You shouldn't have enjoyed it in the first place.
I want to be clear that I don't think the ending of Attack on Titan is a coherent statement about free will or fascism or indeed anything. Series mangaka Hajime Isayama certainly has fascist leanings, but his only apparent commitment is to absolute pessimism. To a sense that humanity is in full self-driving mode, hurtling toward endlessly repeating disasters that will almost but never quite completely wipe it out. I think one thing we can learn from Attack on Titan is that being afraid or confused or depressed makes you more receptive to a fascist worldview, and therefore, that horror might not be the best vehicle for undermining the cult of death. So then, what about comedy? Helldivers 2 inverts Attack on Titan's most effective trick, leaning into the ways that soldiers are benighted by low information, and also the ways that they're lauded as heroes while being simultaneously, materially treated as entirely expendable, plays all of that for dark comedy. Instead of the creeping sense that there are awful truths that soldiers don't know and will likely die without knowing, there's the much more obvious, equally awful truth that those details don't matter and were never the point. That the pretexts for war are very exactly that. Pretexts. Whereas the Eldians of parody are trapped, herded like cattle, as Attack on Titan loves to remind us, Super-Earth is pretty invariably the galaxio-political aggressor. Helldivers 2 takes place at the end of a 100-year period of expansionism known in-world as the Great Democratization, and to whatever degree Super-Earth is under threat, the threats are threats of their own making. Socialist automata, possibly trying to rescue their equally scare quotes socialist cyborg creators, whom Super-Earth have imprisoned. Insectoid terminids that mutated into more dangerous, more spacefaring forms after being farmed for their precious E710, the substance that fuels faster than light travel. These bits of background, of course, give the game away. We're the baddies. To once again quote Ruben Ferdinand and Elliot Trinidad,
"You tend to side with the people trapped in the cage, not those out of it."
But is it even possible to be sufficiently clear about this kind of critique? Can you make fascist iconography or ideology so ridiculous that actual fascists won't appropriate for their for-real fascism? Again, an example from beyond the world of games might be instructive. Paul Verhoeven's film Starship Troopers, a very direct inspiration for Helldivers 2, is the classic example of an adaptation that comprehensively undermines its source material. It takes Robert Heinlein's original story with its largely approving vision of an expansionist forever war waged by a republic with compulsory military service at the center of its politics, and renders those things grotesque and cartoonish, or like, you know, places those things in a text that knows that they're grotesque and cartoonish. Which is not, of course, to say that everyone gets the joke. You don't have to look hard to find people who've missed the satirical bent of the film entirely, or who interpret it just as sci-fi schlock, or who simply think that, as an adaptation, it failed to capture the best parts of the book. So Verhoeven has frequently been at pains to explain what he meant when he made the least subtle film ever made. You know what? Let me just go ahead and play you the first 2 minutes of the DVD commentary to Starship Troopers.
The voice you're hearing here now is Paul Verhoeven, the director of Starship Troopers.
And this is Ed Neumeier, the writer of Starship Troopers.
And we are here in the middle of controversy immediately. It's interesting, I'm quoting here an article of Richard Schickel in Time magazine, who said that maybe it's saying that war inevitably makes fascists of us all. Then, of course, he says that the best guess that the filmmakers didn't think about anything like that at all because they were only concerned about special effects. But I can tell you that the movie is, in fact, in our opinion, stating that war makes fascists of us all.
That's true. That was the theme. And this opening was modeled on the Why We Fight films of World War II. In fact, this whole movie is modeled on propaganda films made during the World War II.
Yeah, they're propaganda films from the American propaganda films. And of course, there is also clearly a disguised statement about propaganda films of the Third Reich. In fact, it's saying, of course, that this fascist propaganda that is kind of apparent in the movie should be really read, at least that's how we meant it, should be read as something that is not good. So whenever you see something that you think is fascist, you should know that the makers coincide with your opinion thinking that it is not good. That is not a good statement, and this is not good politics. And if you see a black uniform, you should also know bad, bad, bad. You know, it's very simple. You should not read it differently than that. We all agree with that. It's bad. If you see Carl later in a black uniform, And when he makes certain statements, and we'll come back to that later, then you know that it's about bad.
It seems ridiculous to say that Starship Troopers, of all things, is too subtle or too deadpan or not funny enough for its points to land. The thing is, though, if we're insisting that a text functions a certain way and should be read a certain way, but a significant portion of the audience doesn't notice or care, then at some point, that does need to figure into our reading somehow, right? Satire depends on being mistaken, if only momentarily, for the thing it's satirizing. But if the person or group you're making fun of benefits from their depiction or finds it kind of flattering, then satirically speaking, you've fucked up. This is why The Onion retired their Diamond Joe character, an affably goofy version of Joe Biden. As Onion alum Joe Garden said,
"As a guideline, if the people you're satirizing aren't mad, then you should dig deeper."
So let's actually take that as a baseline. What are the depictions of fascism that fascists are least likely to like, or to find a use for, to appropriate for their own purposes? There's an argument to be made that outright comedy is uniquely hard to appropriate. Lindsay Ellis talked about this in the context of Nazi imagery, Edward Norton's character in American History X being framed as bad, but also badass. Hans Landa in Inglourious Basterds being charmingly unhinged.
And you might argue that that's the point. But how valuable is that point if what people remember most about the movie is how fun the evil Nazi was? Audiences might have lost the thread of the intended point. And then there's Tomorrow Belongs to Me, a chilling moment from the film version of Cabaret.
Tomorrow belongs to me.
Which has recently been adopted by some white nationalists as an anthem.
But do you know what hasn't?
Springtime for Hitler and Germany. Deutschland is happy and gay.
We're marching to a faster pace. Look out, here comes the master race.
Springtime for Hitler. The musical within a musical from Mel Brooks' The Producers, a silly-as-hell dressing down of fascist kitsch. Actual factual fascists have intermittently laid claim to the Tomorrow Belongs to Me scene from Cabaret, in which a surprising number of regular-ass people seem roused by the false promises of Nazism and therefore join in singing a song about some glorious Nazified neo-pastoral future. That fascists can get behind once it's liberated from its original context. But by contrast, Mel Brooks' rhyming faster pace with master race does seem to be sufficiently silly to make the text unmistakable and unreclaimable. Perhaps this level of goofiness is the best way to make it abundantly clear
that it's about bad.
But Helldivers 2 is doing something that The Producers, by way of Springtime for Hitler, definitely isn't doing, that Starship Troopers more is. It's letting you indulge in precisely the thing it's mocking. And this is a famously tricky proposition. It's how you get people thinking that Patrick Bateman or Walter White rule, actually. When you prop a character like that up just to knock them down, you run the risk of making the propping up the more memorable part. A cult of personality can form around the protagonist, which happened with Attack on Titan as well, but seriously, we're not getting into that here. Helldivers 2 has an interesting solution to this problem as well. None of the characters you care about are anybody in particular. Every time your character dies, which is often, that character stays dead, and your next Helldiver is a fresh recruit. In that context, Arrowhead's signature approach to comedically disastrous co-op gameplay pays dividends. The parodic lethality of the missions. These much-glorified agents of state violence ragdolling clownishly through the air in boneless indignity. For all that the game does indulge in the aesthetic pleasures of fascism, the swelling music, the helmets, the capes, it does insist on putting you in the shoes of a regular person, and regular people never do well under fascism in the end. Helldivers 2 is able to do this in part because of its structure. There doesn't have to be a stable player character or a story protagonist, so the in-world soldiers can be considered as disposable as actual soldiers are, even as they're flattered and celebrated in the ways that actual soldiers are. Structurally, Starship Troopers couldn't just kill our hero Johnny Rico in the first act and then keep throwing new guys at us. Even Attack on Titan, initially and perhaps prophetically lauded as the Game of Thrones of anime for its willingness to abruptly kill named characters, eventually conjures in-world reasons for most of its main cast to be functionally immortal. Helldivers 2 is able to do what it does specifically because it operates outside the rules of conventional linear narrative. One rule among those being a relatively fixed core cast. This is not, of course, to say that players are any less attached to their Helldivers than they would be to other sorts of player characters. In the early days of the game's release, the Helldivers subreddit, this piece very nearly became an ethnography of the Helldivers subreddit, the Helldivers subreddit was full of players having a difficult time processing the inevitable deaths of their avatars. The idea of churning through player character after player character almost has to be played for dark comedy, specifically because it does so little to dull players' identification with those characters. And I think there's something even sneakier happening here. The in-game narrative frames you as a hero of Super Earth, which is to say, as a villain. But that narrative is only ever at the margins, as I've said. Moment to moment, the story is one of heroism under ludicrously hostile conditions, and just as importantly, of cooperation. I was playing with one specific friend for the first time when he picked up a resource and instinctively thought he'd thereby stolen it from the rest of the group. No, I explained, those sorts of pickups are shared in this game. So he said, in his best I'm going to report you to my democracy officer voice, that seems pretty communist. All your glories in Helldivers 2 come from collective action, from working together for a common cause, from coordinating and muddling through. The bad situations you're in, meanwhile, originate from the powers that be on Super Earth, either indirectly, since we're the aggressors and the baddies and all, or directly, in the form of the obscenely dangerous missions themselves. There are mission prompts and key locations marked on your map, but beyond that, certainly by the standard of a modern AAA action game, you're largely left to figure out for yourself, for yourselves, how to get the messy, violent, frantic work done and maybe even get out alive. There's a weird sense of agency to it, despite Helldivers textually having roughly none. The game has its cake and eats it too, in this sense. You get the rousing affect of glorified warfare, and you laugh at the brutal absurdity of glorifying warfare, at the hollowness of jingoistic chest-thumping rhetoric. You're playing at believing in a ludicrous ideology, even as you laugh at how paper-thin that ideology is. If we're asking whether this is a better way to wield fascist imagery, then we're kind of also asking whether it's a way to address the contradiction that François Truffaut famously observed.
I find that violence is very ambiguous in movies. For example, some films claim to be anti-war, but I don't think I've really seen an anti-war film. Every film about war ends up being pro-war.
And here the interviewer asks,
even a film like Kubrick's Paths of Glory or his Dr. Strangelove?
Yes, I think Kubrick likes violence very much.
Can you directly depict war and make that depiction into an anti-war statement? Or, at the end of the day, are you showing it and do you want to see it because in some undeniable way, you just like it? I mean, as I'm by no means the first to point out, there are unambiguously anti-war films. Grave of the Fireflies and Johnny Got His Gun come to mind. But they, like lots of other anti-war media through the ages, from Francisco Goya's print series The Disasters of War to 11-bit Studios' survival game This War of Mine, manage to be anti-war by focusing on the aftermath of war, or the effects of war on non-combatants, anything but the fighting itself. Spec Ops The Line is a game that's more like the films about which Truffaut was expressing his skepticism, in that it tries to make an anti-war statement, or more exactly an anti-war game statement, a statement against propaganda as entertainment, while very much focusing on the fighting itself. It advertises itself as yet another jingoistic xenophobic man-shoot about American heroism in hostile foreign places before pulling the rug out from under the player and becoming a searing meditation on those kinds of games. As Mark Brown recently said,
while it might start as a standard military shooter, towards the end of the campaign, it feels more like a horror game. In fact, the unreliable narrator, the hallucinations, and the way you seem to always be descending deeper and deeper into the heart of Dubai, well, this game often feels more like Silent Hill 2 than Call of Duty.
In Helldivers 2, the gameplay is all but entirely about the fighting itself. You have your own spaceship and a galaxy to explore, but you only ever see the bits of the galaxy that currently need to be liberated. You're only ever on a battlefield or on your way to the next one. The violence is very much the focus. And yet, Helldivers 2 is different from Spec Ops The Line in that there's no rug pull, or else in that there's a constant rug pull. It stays a co-op shooter, indeed stays fun, if a chaotic and failure-prone kind of fun, throughout. The point doesn't come from a switcheroo. Nor does the point come from player disempowerment, as it does in, say, Lethal Company. Again, the player character is, in a mechanical sense, absurdly powerful, though in a political sense, not so much. So in this way, Helldivers 2 plays at, and lets you play at, being pro-war. It does not deny the pleasures of playing soldier, nor does it shame you for wanting to indulge in them, as Spec Ops The Line does. Helldivers 2 indulges in these pleasures, it revels in them. But at the same time, it insists on staying clear-eyed about how childish the fantasy is, how fanciful, how disconnected from the realities of war. I have a soft spot for this approach, because for as long as I've been studying history, I've thought that you can only really understand history by recognizing its absurdity. The very idea that humans go to war is fucking ridiculous. To see it instead as glorious and necessary is the first step towards seeing it as inevitable. Not just seeing war as something that will always continue to happen, but seeing any given war as unavoidable. Seeing attempts at avoiding or ending wars as hopelessly naive. Follow this line of thinking all the way to its logical conclusion and you end up where Hajime Isayama ends up with Attack on Titan, thinking that humankind is doomed to endless cycles of always horrific but never quite utterly fatal self-immolation. That way of thinking is just trash. It's no good. I'm genuinely not sure whether Helldivers 2's exercise in cognitive dissonance or in ambivalence represents a healthier alternative. Maybe? I guess the proof will be in whether it gets widely appropriated. I guess we'll see whether reactionaries start posting Helldivers-based pro-Trump memes. Because there were certainly pro-Trump memes based in Warhammer 40K. There are certainly Warhammer 40K Nazis who are told fairly often, though perhaps not nearly often enough, to fuck off. This despite Warhammer 40K being about as subtle as an orbital strike. Will we see people unironically, though of course also always ironically, equating the United States' less democratic or more anti-democratic institutions, like the Supreme Court, or the Senate, or the way we do voting, with managed democracy on Super Earth? Like, will we see them doing it in an approving way, the way that reactionaries will sometimes trot out the idea from Starship Troopers that service guarantees citizenship as a fine and pro-social political principle? I don't know. We'll see. It makes me nervous, if I'm honest. Hundreds of millions of people playing at fascism in a time of rising fascism. How many of them are laughing at the, to me, clearly intended targets, and how many are actually sort of half-convinced by Super Earth's propaganda? How many are just really committed to the bit, and how many are trying on a fascist ideology to find out whether it fits? They themselves, in many cases, might not know. Identifying with fascist heroes, who are nonetheless interchangeable and disposable and comprehensively denied dignity. That's sort of a novel approach, and one that's really only possible in a game, and more specifically in Arrowhead's quite particular style of game. But what that approach does, how it works in the long term, we can't yet know. It's fun. It's funny. And it sure makes me long for a democracy that's much less managed. Thanks to El Villegas for playing Ruben Ferdinand and or Elliot Trinidad, as well as Sigmund Freud and Francois Truffaut. And thanks to Emerson Boatwright for playing Umberto Eco and Joe Garden. This episode of the Everybody's Talking at Once podcast was hosted and produced by me, Drew Messenger Michaels, with support from Francis Michelle Cannon, Lucio Valentino, and El Villegas. Our logo is by Aaron Perry Zucker, using icons from The Noun Project. The current version of our theme song is by me. You can find more music that I make at carpedemon.band, or by checking out the last several charity EP jams at charityepjam.bandcamp.com. Truly appreciate you listening. Zero pressure to do anything other than listen. But if you like the show so much that you are moved to do something more, then I truly appreciate it, and here's what you can do. You can tell a friend about the show, you can give us a good rating or review, or if and only if it causes you absolutely no financial hardship, you can throw us a few bucks on Patreon at patreon.com/ETAO. Tremendous thanks to our current patrons, with a special thanks to Carlos de los Santos and Darth Raptora. And an even specialer thanks to the mysterious Ian K., Lucas Cosin, and Sylvain Dufresne. Hope to see you in 2 weeks. Until then, do take care of yourselves, do take care of each other, and so long for now, everybody.
Baruch atah Adonai, Eloheinu melech haolam, she'asa nisim avoteinu bayamim ha'am bazman hazeh.
Thank you very much. So great.
Sir, on this occasion, peace and celebration, can you tell us how you were struck by this Jumanji videotape?
Just reminded me what a murderer he is and how right and just our cause is. I couldn't imagine somebody like Osama bin Laden understanding the joy of Hanukkah or the joy of Christmas, of celebrating peace and hope. This man wants to destroy any semblance of civilization for his own power and his own good. He's so evil that he's willing to send young men to commit suicide while he hides in caves. While we celebrate peace and lightness, I fully understand in order to make sure peace and lightness exist in the future, we must bring him to justice, and we will. But for those who see this tape, they'll realize that not only is he guilty of incredible murder, he has no conscience and no soul, that he represents the worst of civilization.